This episode contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. In February of 1987, Vicky Heath was a 41-year-old divorcee that had just recently moved to Radcliffe, Kentucky, about 45 miles south of Louisville. A mother of two adult children, Vicky had been attempting to rebuild her life in the months prior to the move, and had finally taken the plunge at the behest of her new fiancé, a fiancé that encouraged her to start the next chapter of her life. Her second act, in a new town. Prior to the move, Vicky had spent the better part of her life in her hometown of Hardinsburg, Kentucky, where she had raised her two children, a son and a daughter, who had already moved out and on with their adult lives. To help ease the burden on her hardworking fiancé, and provide a second income for their new home, Vicky decided to take a job at a nearby Super 8 motel in neighboring Elizabethtown. This was and is a small town that serves as the county seat for Kentucky's Hardin County, and is perhaps most well known as the birthplace of Abraham Lincoln. Here, at the Super 8, Vicky would end up working as a night auditor, where she would monitor the Super 8 for the hotel's managers and work the front desk overnight. While this may sound a bit intimidating, for Vicky, it was a good opportunity to get paid for reading romance novels, which she was also known to do in her off hours. The Elizabethtown Super 8 was just one of two small motels in the northeastern corner of the town, alongside a Days Inn, which was located just down the street. The two were separated by a large, empty parking lot, where truck drivers could pull in for a night and catch some shut-eye. On February 20th, 1987, a Friday, Vicky was gearing up for another overnight shift at the Super 8, which was destined to be another quiet evening, with the occupancy rate at around 50% that night. The motel manager stayed there with Vicky until roughly 11 p.m., when he would leave the motel in Vicky's care until the morning. He would later recall, up to that point, everything seeming quiet, and there seeming to be nothing out of the ordinary. That night, temperatures hovered just around freezing, which was very indicative of that year's brisk Midwestern winter. In the early morning hours, frozen flakes began to fall on the area, covering up everything in a thin sheet of snow. At around 6:30 a.m., guests at the motel began to stir and make their way down to the Super 8 lobby in an attempt to check out. However, when they got to the lobby, they found it to be in a state of chaos. They would also discover that there were no staff members within it, and they were now unable to check out from the motel. At 6:38, a call was received by the Elizabethtown Police Department, which described the lobby as being in, quote, a complete mess, in total disarray, unquote. Guests were worried that something had happened the night prior, since the scene in the motel lobby seemed to point to a violent encounter having taken place. A police officer would arrive at the scene a short time later, and would note that the lobby was, in fact, a chaotic mess. Furniture had been overturned, numerous items were scattered all over the floor, and the payphone had been ripped from the wall. This officer would later theorize that there had been a brawl between several people, and he was immediately concerned that someone, perhaps the motel's night auditor, had been seriously injured in the process. This officer would call for backup, but begin searching the property for any sign of the motel's clerk, or a continued struggle. Unfortunately, this police officer would eventually find the front desk clerk on the motel's property, but this discovery would send shockwaves through the local community, who now had to fear that a killer lurked among them. The body of 41-year-old Vicky Heath was found outside behind the motel's dumpster, having been left in a muddy and bloody mess. Lieutenant Reuben Gardner would arrive at the scene a short time later, just a few minutes before sunrise, and would later note that the body of Vicky Heath was lying on its back in, quote, dead muddy grass caused by fresh melted snow, unquote. Vicky was still wearing her sweater and plaid skirt from the prior evening, but the clothing was tangled and had many noticeable rips, pointing to a vicious struggle between her and an attacker, who had likely fought Vicky in the motel lobby and then forced her outside, eventually taking her behind the motel's dumpster. There, she had been subjected to a vicious sexual assault. with an autopsy later revealing that she had been sodomized. After this, she had been shot twice in the head with a 38 caliber firearm. One of the bullets had exited through Vicky's skull and embedded itself into the ground, where it was later recovered by investigators. In addition, a rape kit would later be performed, which was able to obtain usable DNA from this attacker, and this was later paired with additional DNA evidence left behind by this individual on Vicky's clothing. However, at this time, February of 1987, this evidence was anything but definitive, and would simply be preserved for the time being. Following the discovery of Vicky Heath's body, investigators began to spread out from the crime scene. They quickly found a set of muddy footprints leading away from the body, which seemed to head straight to a parking lot nearby, likely where the killer hopped in his vehicle and then drove away. Unfortunately, because the area was covered in a thin layer of snow, which had actually started to melt shortly before investigators arrived, they were unable to recover much more than these few footprints. The treads of the killer's vehicle were impossible to make out or get any working impressions of. This crime quickly stumped investigators, who struggled to ascertain the motive of Vicky Heath's killer. It was impossible to determine whether or not this was a robbery gone wrong, a crime of passion, or, as one investigator theorized, quote, a targeted rape and execution, unquote. However, after several days of probing Vicky's background, investigators were no closer to identifying any potential suspects, and Lieutenant Reuben Gardner would later tell the press, quote, we have no substantial suspects yet, unquote. Despite the hard work of numerous detectives and other police officials throughout the years, Vicky Heath's murder would remain unsolved, with her unknown rapist and killer being able to get away with this crime, which police, at the time at least, believed was a one-off, an isolated incident. However, more than two decades later, DNA taken from the scene of Vicky Heath's murder would find a match in the Combined DNA Index System, CODIS, to a supposedly separate offender who had targeted similar victims in the years after Vicky's grisly end. That killer had already escaped justice for other heinous crimes, but Vicky's death was believed to be the first chapter in this dark and morbid saga, making her the first known victim of an unknown subject who blurs the line between serial and spree killer. This is the story of the I-65 killer, also known as the Days Inn killer. Mary Margaret Gill, more commonly known as Peggy among her friends and family, was the youngest of four children, and at the age of 24, she still lived with her parents, Anna and Terry Gill, in the region of Merrillville, Indiana, about an hour southeast of Chicago, and a short drive south from Gary, Indiana. Peggy had grown up in Merrillville, and had actually graduated from Merrillville High School a handful of years prior. There, she had been a member of the Future Homemakers of America Club, and regularly competed in local baking contests. Peggy loved to bake, and was an avid artist, who seized upon every opportunity to flex her creative muscles. Peggy had later attended and graduated from Sawyer Business College, a now defunct school that would change its name to Kaplan College years later, before closing forever. However, to help pay her way through college, Peggy had taken a job at a local Days Inn hotel in Merrillville, where she started off as a hotel maid. However, she quickly endeared herself to her colleagues and supervisors, primarily through her kind and giving nature, as well as her propensity to bake them decorative birthday cakes, and she would quickly receive a promotion to night auditor. Betty Pierce, the general manager of the Merrillville Days Inn, later said about Peggy, quote, she was kind of shy and timid. She preferred the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift, because the nights were quieter and not as hectic, unquote. In this position, Peggy could work the front desk overnight, and dedicate at least some time every evening to her art, whether it be drawing, painting, or cross-stitching. This Days Inn hotel was located near Interstate 65 and US 30, which intersected in downtown Merrillville. Located just off of exit 253, this made it a prime location for truckers, traveling salesmen, and other long-distance travelers, as Merrillville existed on the very edge of the Chicago metropolitan area, and could perhaps provide drivers a chance to pull off and get gas, food, or rest before entering the frantic pace of Chicago traffic. May 2nd, 1989, was a normal Thursday for Peggy Gill, who was scheduled to work that evening. Peggy spent the early part of the evening with her father, Terry, whose birthday was the following day, March 3rd. Peggy was planning on throwing him a party, and spent this precious time before work with him, as she also put the finishing touches on his decorative birthday cake. Before leaving for work, Peggy hugged Terry and wished him a, quote, early happy birthday, old man. The two had no way of knowing at the time that the following day, Terry's 51st birthday, would be one of the worst days of his entire life. Just before 11 p.m., Peggy arrived at the Days Inn that she worked at, and relieved the clerk that had been working the second shift. It was a relatively busy night, with approximately 70 rooms in the hotel booked, and the other clerk would stick around for approximately 15 minutes after Peggy arrived, before leaving herself. Over the next several hours, the temperature in Merrillville would dip down into the mid-20s, which was well below freezing, and felt even colder due to the brisk winds that sustained throughout the night. But as the sun slowly approached the horizon, the temperature began to incrementally rise. We know that Peggy's overnight shift went by swimmingly for at least a couple of hours, with her starting her shift at 11 and speaking to the hotel's GM, Betty Pierce, over the telephone just a short time later. At the time of their conversation, Peggy described a rather boring shift thus far, and that seemed to be that. Between 1:30 and 1:40 a.m., Peggy would check in a guest at the hotel, who later described this check-in process as uneventful. It is believed that up until this point, everything was hunky-dory at the Merrillville Days Inn. However, at around 2, an 18-year-old college student from the Chicago area Hiles Anderson College arrived at the Merrillville Days Inn. He claimed that he entered the lobby and attempted to check in, but found no one inside. No guest lurking about. No employees, just nothing. This young man said that he waited around for upwards of 5 minutes before deciding to bail and head to a neighboring hotel. This time period, between 1:30 and 2 o'clock in the morning, is when police believe something untoward happened inside of the Days Inn. Hours later, at around 5 a.m., Peggy was supposed to call the hotel's GM, Betty Pierce, at home. This had become a custom for the overnight shift, since the area's hotels had been robbed a few times in the preceding months, and these phone calls provided at least some kind of security for the overnight staff, who were otherwise defenseless. Despite being a model employee that never failed to check in, Peggy failed to call Betty this morning. And within minutes of the expected 5 o'clock check-in, Betty started calling the hotel herself. After failing to make contact with her younger employee, Betty then decided to phone the police. Officers with the Merrillville Police Department were dispatched almost immediately, and the first officer arrived at the scene just after 6 o'clock. He immediately noticed that there were no hotel staff in the lobby, but found that there were several customers eager to check out who were all waiting. At this point, police officers began calling Peggy's family and quickly discovered that she wasn't at home with them. This was very unusual because her green Plymouth was still in the hotel's parking lot, and police would soon learn that Peggy's car keys and wallet had been left behind the front desk of the hotel. Despite the signs pointing to Peggy having gone missing under duress, police were calmed by the fact that there seemed to be no sign of an apparent struggle. Officers set out to quarantine the scene, but were assured that there was no reason to panic quite yet. At the time, it was likely that there was a rational explanation for Peggy's disappearance. Years later, one of the responding officers would recall, quote, I waited for the manager to arrive, pretty confident that she'd, Peggy, be somewhere on the premises, with people outside and nothing out of the ordinary. A large hotel, she may have had to attend to something, and it wouldn't be the first time an employee crashed in a room either, unquote. However, within minutes, the laid-back attitude of the responding officers began to whittle away. The hotel's general manager, Betty Pierce, arrived at the hotel a short time later and showed police to the cash drawer, which had been pried open with significant force. Money was missing, but it would later be determined to be a paltry sum, $179. This gave rise to the notion that an armed robbery had likely taken place, which, obviously, escalated the situation tremendously. Upon Betty's arrival, she informed the officers that there was an entire wing of the hotel that wasn't clear. It was a vacant wing that was closed for the winter months and was not being occupied by any guest. Officers would continue to scour the premises for Peggy, and one of the officers took this opportunity to browse through this vacant hallway of the hotel. It was there that a grisly discovery would be made. At the end of the hallway in the vacant wing of the Merrillville Days Inn, the body of 24-year-old Peggy Gill would be found. This was at the furthest point of the hotel from the lobby, located next to a fire exit. Lying beside the body was the young woman's clothing, which, according to a detective, had been left, quote, folded neatly by her nude body, unquote. It would later be determined that Peggy had been raped and then shot twice in the head with a .22 caliber firearm. Specifically, right behind her left ear. However, other than the gunshots and a fresh-looking cut on her left shoulder, there was no other sign of violent trauma having been inflicted upon her, indicative of no struggle having taken place. The investigation into this crime was headed by Detective Daniel Demon of the Merrillville Police Department, and later, Sergeant Herb Clear of the Indiana State Police, whose involvement I'll detail later. Initially, investigators theorized that this crime had been committed by, quote, a sexual deviant on a rampage, unquote, that had arrived at the hotel sometime between 1:30 and 2 o'clock a.m. After entering the Days Inn, they believe, this man had proceeded to rob, rape, and kill Peggy, in that order, in the hotel lobby, before dragging her body upstairs into the vacant hallway on the second floor of the Days Inn. However, this theory would evolve as more evidence came in, which included, but was not limited to, Peggy's folded clothing. When police found Peggy's remains in the hallway upstairs, they found her clothing lying right next to her in a neatly folded pile. This was an unusual detail for a crime like this, as it seemed to be very unusual for a violent sexual offender to fold up the clothing either before or after raping and murdering his victim. This detail would become an important point in the official narrative moving forward. The theory then became, the attacker had entered the lobby of the Days Inn, and began robbing Peggy at gunpoint. He then likely guided Peggy upstairs to the vacant wing on the second floor, which only Peggy would have known was closed for the season. Maybe she thought that luring the gunman to a quiet and/or isolated location would deter him from harming any other guest, or perhaps from committing any violent acts. There, he likely forced her to take off her clothing, and as she did so, she instinctively folded it and laid it beside her on the ground. What then followed was a sexual assault, and then the tragic taking of Peggy's life via two .22 rounds. Police found it very unlikely for the killer to have scoped out the hotel ahead of time. This crime reeked of an impulsive act, which was not really well thought out in any way. Nonetheless, investigators believed that Peggy, a quiet and cooperative person, would have likely given in to her attacker's demands with or without a firearm, and her killer had inflicted violence upon her for no other reason than his own self-gratification. Robbery was not believed to have played a strong motive in the crime, due to the assailant making off with approximately $179 from the hotel's cash drawer. However, the robbery itself was hard to overlook, especially since the cash drawer in the hotel's lobby had been forcibly removed from the desk it was situated within, pointing to a violent and desperate action from an unhinged individual. This provided proof that the killer had likely started off the assault as a robbery, and it then progressed from there. It became clear to investigators that this was not a personal crime, as there was nobody in Peggy's life or social circle that would have targeted her for such a crime, and that would almost become verified in the hours and days to come. You see, it was soon learned that on the same night as Peggy's murder, a similar crime had been reported at another Days Inn hotel about an hour away. away, a crime that had unfolded almost identically to this one. We're going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsor. As you all know, true crime is one of my many passions, but every now and then, even I need the occasional break. Sometimes it's baseball, sometimes it's metal music, but other times it's just a nice little game to keep my mind engaged. Best Fiends, yes, Best Friends without the R, is a casual puzzle game that anyone can play and download for free, and is constantly being updated every month with new levels and events. It does not require internet to play, so I'm able to play it while taking the metro around here in DC, and it is a lot of fun. I just started playing Best Fiends, so I'm not very far in, but I'll be sure to update you all with my progress throughout the year, as I learn more about the quirky little characters you could play as, the bugs, and their evil villains, the slugs. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And remember, that's Best Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Now, let's return to the show. Jeannie Marie Gilbert was born on November 18, 1954, to Andrew and Patricia Mitchell. She would grow up in Jasper County, Indiana, specifically in a small town named Rensselaer, where she would live for most of her life. While Jeannie would marry at an early age, she and her husband would end up divorcing several years later, when their two children, Kimberly and Scott, were in their teenage years. Following this separation, Jeannie and her children would move in with her parents, while she took a beat and began to plan out her next steps. Even though she had been working as a bookkeeper for Carter Oil Supply for several years, Jeannie began to supplement her income with a second part-time job at the Days Inn Hotel in the neighboring town of Remington. She became the night auditor there, and this position gave her some quiet time at least twice a week to focus on her schoolwork. You see, in addition to working these two jobs, Jeannie was also taking college classes at nearby St. Joseph's, where she was studying business. It was clear to everyone that Jeannie, this hardworking single mother, was trying to provide a comfortable life for her children. Despite going through a rather rough period in her own personal life, Jeannie never lost her fun and free-spirited attitude among her colleagues and loved ones. March 2nd, 1989, unfolded just like every other Thursday in Jeannie's life, with one notable exception. She had decided to switch work shifts with a coworker at the Days Inn so that she could attend a cheerleading event for her daughter the next day, Friday. So, that Thursday evening, at around 11 p.m., Jeannie started her work shift, working alongside the front desk clerk from the second shift for about an hour. At around midnight, though, the other clerk would leave for the night, leaving Jeannie as the sole employee at the Days Inn for the next several hours. This Days Inn, located in Remington, Indiana, was similar to the Merrillville branch from 50 miles away, in that both were located just off of Interstate 65. But unlike its northern counterpart, the Remington Days Inn was much smaller, and was located virtually in the middle of nowhere. You see, Remington was and is a very small town, with a population of just around 1,000. The surrounding area is mostly rural farmland, and other than a few shops and gas stations around the hotel, many of which have been constructed in the years since, there really wasn't much else in the area. It is believed that Jeannie spent the next several hours in a side room of the hotel lobby, where she worked on some homework for her college classes, while monitoring the front desk for any guests or disturbances. Before we continue, I just want to let you know that, for the next couple of minutes, I'm going to be using Central Standard Time to describe the events that unfold. I am doing so and letting you know because Jasper County, where Jeannie Gilbert lived and worked, uses Central Time, but at the time this story unfolded, residents in Remington used Eastern Time. This is because neighboring White County, where this story eventually takes us, also uses Eastern Time. This led to some discrepancies early on, and I'd figured that I would let you know in case you do some research or reading of your own and encounter some confusion. I'm going to stick to Central Time, in an effort to keep the timeline accurate with the events upstate from Merrillville. At around 4:30 a.m. on Friday, March 3rd, Jeannie made a courtesy wake-up call to a guest at the Days Inn, with Jasper County Sheriff Stephen Reams later stating that there was, quote, nothing unusual about the call, but this is someone who doesn't know Jeannie Gilbert and did not check in with her. They never once interacted, unquote. Despite this being a rather odd statement on Sheriff Reams' part, it is believed that everything in the hotel was fine up until this point, at least. That would soon change. About an hour and a half later, at around 6 a.m., the Jasper County Sheriff's Office began to receive calls from customers at the Remington Days Inn. The customers claimed that they were attempting to check out, but were unable to do so, as there were no employees at the location to assist them. Officers quickly arrived at the scene, and discovered that the door to the hotel registration office was locked. Another hotel employee, Jeannie's morning replacement, had arrived at the scene and was also waiting to be let in, but did not have a key of her own. So, with police and staff unable to gain access to the lobby, the hotel's general manager, Sharon Krug, was contacted. She began heading to the hotel, while those at the scene tried to figure out what had happened to the overnight employee, Jeannie, who was nowhere to be found. As this was unfolding, almost simultaneously, the Indiana State Police were contacted by a school bus driver in neighboring White County. This bus driver informs the ISP that they have discovered a nude body lying on the side of County Road 150 West, a body that appears to be female. A state trooper with the ISP began to respond to that scene, as did a handful of officers with the White County Sheriff's Department, who were alerted to the discovery at the same time. Over the next 30 or so minutes, two discoveries would be made at almost the same time. At the Remington Days Inn, police officers finally gain access to the hotel's registration office, and quickly discover that a robbery has taken place. The cash drawer had been pried open, and approximately $247 was missing. The front desk clerk, Jeannie Gilbert, was also missing from the scene, having left behind her purse, keys, and school books. Meanwhile, the second discovery would take place out along County Road 150 West, just south of 900 South. Police arrive at the location of the reported nude body, and discover that the victim is indeed a woman, who appears to have been sexually assaulted, murdered, and then dumped along the side of the road. Within hours, the remains would be identified as the missing Days Inn employee, 34-year-old Jeannie Gilbert. The investigation into Jeannie's death was initially headed by two separate police agencies, who responded to the different crime scenes that morning. First, there was the Indiana State Police, who found Jeannie's body in a different county, and then there was the Jasper County Sheriff's Office, who began investigating the perplexing crime scene left behind at the hotel. Their investigations would eventually converge under the supervision of the ISP, but at least for the first few hours, there was a lot of confusion and overlapping jurisdictions. Based off of the evidence left behind by the culprit, as well as some other factors which I'll eventually get to, police were able to figure out a likely series of events that had started in the hotel lobby and eventually led to the abandoning of Jeannie's lifeless body roughly 20 miles away. It is believed that the killer entered the hotel lobby sometime between 4:30 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and, using a firearm, managed to subdue Jeannie in some capacity. He then began robbing the hotel, ripping open the cash drawer with force, and ultimately making off with approximately $247. However, like the other attack just a few hours prior in Merrillville, this unknown subject decided that he wasn't satisfied with the money, likely using Jeannie's work keys. This assailant then locked the front doors of the hotel's registration office, and then guided her at gunpoint through an exterior steel door in the side office. He likely led her towards a vehicle in the parking lot, and proceeded to drive away for the next several miles. Based off of the location that Jeannie Gilbert's body was found, it is believed that the killer likely fled down I-65 until he reached exit 188, which was the exit for Indiana State Road 18, heading towards Brookston. This was not believed to be a coincidence, as this was the first exit without any hotel, gas, or food signs, indicating that it was a less traveled road than others nearby. He then drove until he reached CR 900 South, eventually finding an empty clearing. This sense of privacy likely provided this unknown subject with the means to commit the sexual assault, and then kill Jeannie without being noticed or seen. Jeannie's body was found here hours after her abduction, having been dumped along the side of the road. As I stated earlier, she was found nude, with the exception of her shoes and socks, which she was still wearing. She was also still wearing her jewelry, which included earrings and at least a couple of rings. On the other hand, her Days Inn uniform, which she had been seen wearing just hours earlier, was nowhere to be found, likely taken by the killer as a type of souvenir, or discarded elsewhere. Jeannie's autopsy would note several scrapes and scratches on her body, which indicated to investigators that she had been physically dragged out of a vehicle. This led to the theory that Jeannie was sexually assaulted and potentially killed at an unknown third location, and then dumped here in rural White County. However, investigators would be unable to determine where this third location might have been, or if Jeannie had even been dead at the time of the scrape. Perhaps she had simply been fighting back, and refused to leave the vehicle she was in because she knew what that meant for her odds of surviving. Police would never state definitively that Jeannie had been raped, but they did state publicly that there were signs of a sexual assault. They would also reveal that the killer had left behind multiple DNA samples, some of which was undoubtedly semen. Jeannie's autopsy would reveal that she had been shot 3 times with a .22 caliber firearm. Once in the back of the head, behind her left ear, once in a shoulder blade, and then once in the left side of her torso, which was believed to have been the fatal shot, surprisingly. Larry Smith, the coroner for White County, would later verify this by listing her cause of death as internal blood loss, and publicly stating, quote, "The fatal shot entered next to her left breast, went through the lung, and pierced her aorta, the body's main blood vessel," unquote. Despite no one having directly seen the commission of the crime itself, investigators were able to punch up their timeline of events with a couple of key witness reports. At around 5:30 a.m., an hour after Jeannie was last confirmed to be alive, a farmer near the crime scene reported hearing at least 2 gunshots in quick succession. At around the same time, a school bus driver from White County would recall seeing a, quote, "tan-colored, recent model Toyota window van with its lights on, heading westbound on CR West 700 South near Indiana 43. Unquote. It is believed that this was the time that Jeannie's killer had fired the fatal shots, and then left her body behind in the frozen ditch. This led to the theory that she had likely been abducted from the Days Inn hotel that she worked at, just minutes after making a courtesy wake-up call to a guest, in the time period of 4:30 to 5 a.m., It is unknown if the vehicle description reported by the White County bus driver was ever followed up on, but none of the rather vague evidence left behind at the crime scene would help lead investigators to the culprit of this heinous crime, and without any surveillance footage or similarly incriminating evidence. In an era before forensic testing was commonplace, or even accepted in courtrooms, it would be hard to track down this savage rapist and killer. Captain Bob Hicks of the Jasper County Sheriff's Department would later recall, quote, "The problem is, normally you have some idea of who you're looking for, some type of description. We were just looking for someone who was just suspicious," unquote. Despite the uncertainty of the specific crime, it wasn't long before investigators and reporters began to connect the larger dots. Within a single day, the 2 separate Days Inn murders, the one from Merrillville and the one from Remington, were singled out as having unfolded in almost identical fashion. In both cases, a gunman had sexually assaulted and killed the night auditor of a Days Inn hotel, had pried open the cash drawer to make away with paltry sums, and had left behind .22 caliber bullet fragments in and around his victims. The only real difference seemed to be in the abduction of the second victim, who had been killed in a separate location. But other than that, the crimes were almost identical. For state officials, it was hard to believe that one individual had possibly committed two identical crimes on the same night, separated by over 50 miles. But that seemed to be the case here. As investigators would soon learn, one man had committed both crimes within a single evening, having sexually assaulted and murdered Peggy Gill up in Merrillville, Indiana, before driving south and doing the same thing to Jeannie Gilbert hours later. Like their counterparts down in Remington, police in Merrillville were just as clueless as to who this offender was. Don Markle, the Merrillville assistant police chief at the time, told reporters, quote, "If we ever have a suspect, we would have good evidence in court. We have all kinds of leads, but nothing concrete. We have no sightings, no description, nothing," unquote. In the coming days, weeks, and months, the press would begin to associate these two violent acts, the deaths of Peggy Gill and Jeannie Gilbert, under the moniker of the Days Inn Murders. And the fruitless hunt for this unknown psychopath would continue. On the next episode of Unresolved, you'll learn about the state task force that oversaw this sprawling investigation, and other crimes that may or may not be attributed to the same offender, who would later become known as the I-65 Killer. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Unresolved. Before I begin to wrap up this episode, I would like to extend a huge thank you to my friend Damian Moore, who has been a longtime supporter of this show, not only through Patreon, but through our friendship. He is the curator of the website American Crime Journal, and it is through him and his extensive research that I learned a lot about this killer. It's kind of been Damian's passion project for a really long time, and I honestly cannot thank him enough. If you are at all interested in learning more about the I-65 Killer, or about other criminal cases, as he does cover several, check out his website by searching for American Crime Journal or heading to mytruecrime.com. Once again, that's mytruecrime.com. I have been your host, Michael Whelan. In addition to hosting, I am also responsible for writing and producing this episode, as well as composing all of the music through Amper Music. The exception is, of course, the song you're hearing right now, which is the Unresolved theme song, written and composed by Ailsa Traves. If you would like to learn more about Unresolved or myself, please head to the podcast website at unresolved.me. There, you could find links to all of my sources, including links to Damian's write-ups. You could find episode transcripts, links to the podcast social media sites, the Unresolved store, and much more. Once again, that's at unresolved.me. If you would like to support Unresolved, you could do so with monthly contributions through Patreon, where, in exchange for a few bucks every month, you could get access to exclusive podcast merch, such as stickers, magnets, coasters, t-shirts, and even coffee mugs, as well as bonus podcast episodes. Not only are there exclusive bonus episodes, which are just shorter episodes of this show, but there's also a monthly show called Resolved, where I take on a case that has some kind of resolution. These shows can only be found on Patreon, and you can find the Patreon page by searching for Unresolved through the Patreon app or heading directly to patreon.com/unresolvedpod. Before I go, I would like to include a thank you to all of the wonderful producers who support the show each month through Patreon. These wonderful people are Maggie James, Ben Crocombe, Roberta Jansen, Quill Carter, Peggy Ballard, Laura Hannon, Catherine Vatolaro, Damian Moore, who also researched this episode, Astrid Nyer, Amy Hampton, Emily McMeehan, Scott Meese, Stephen Wilson, Scott Patzold, Marie Vangland, Lori Rodriguez, Jessica Yount, Aimee McGregor, Danny Williams, Sue Kirk, Sarah Moscaritolo, Thomas Ahern, Victoria Reed, Marion Welsh, Seth Morgan, Alyssa Lawton, Kelly Jo Hapgood, my Norwegian buddy Patrick, Sydney Scotton, Meadow Landry, and Rebecca Miller. You all rock. Thank you so much for your continued support, and for your saint-like patience when it comes to the Patreon rewards. I'm still very much a one-man operation that is trying to juggle a handful of different projects at any given moment, so thank you all for being so patient with me. I'll be back next week with the second half of this grisly story, and I hope that until then, you all stay safe. I'll talk to you later.